Hey there, are you sick and tired of feeling sick and tired? Join Adel Kozilski and Faggy Stern as they explore ways to address chronic illness and achieve vibrant health. Your health is your only wealth, and together we can be better. Hashtag healthy you, wealthy you.
Hey, beautiful Wednesday. Good morning to all our listeners. This is the Healthy You, Wealthy You show. And I'm Adel Kozilski, as always, joined by Faggy. It's so nice to see you back in person.
Faggy. So nice to see you back in person.
Faggy's been gallivanting the world. I've been gallivanting the local scene. Though we are always committed to be bringing you content that keeps you healthy. And of course, when you're healthy, you are wealthy. And talking about gallivanting, we've been running after our favorite Dr. Cussell, who's also been gallivanting. So it's actually good that all of us have don't have any more ants in our pants, right, Dr. Cussell?
That's correct, I know. Morning.
Welcome back, Dr. Cussell.
Thank you.
Welcome, welcome. So we are continuing with our series with Dr. Cussell. Previously, we've had two actually podcasts on the respiratory system, which just let me remind listeners that if they have missed, you can always go back into the podcast archive and pick up our discussions. They were fascinating discussions. But when it comes to the respiratory tract and the disorders, there are still many things to discuss. And so we're going to be doing part three today, and that is the lung and its related structure. So over to you, Dr. Cussell.
Thank you so much, Adel and Faggy. It's great to be back. I too have been gallivanting to my eldest grandson's bar mitzvah in London. It was cold, but otherwise it was marvelous. Now, in my previous presentations, I discussed disorders of the upper respiratory tract, followed by a discussion of disorders of the lower respiratory tract. And today's discussion presentation will be probably the most important of all. It will focus on disorders of the lung and its related structures, particularly the pleural membrane, the membrane that covers the lung. The discussion will be in three parts. First part being the developmental or neonatal lung, newborn lung. The second part being the childhood and adult lung, and the third part being the aging lung and its pleural membrane. Start with the developmental or neonatal lung. The developed lung has open honeycomb-like air spaces known as alveoli. And these spaces have within their walls capillary vessels through which the vital interchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide takes place. This interchange of gases is dependent on the breathing mechanism. In other words, the expansion and contraction of the lung, which is brought about by the elastic fibers which surround the alveoli. There is also a pleural membrane which surrounds the lung and separates it from the thoracic cavity and, most importantly, from the heart. The first point to remember about the lung is that if damaged, the lung remains damaged. It has no regenerative capacity. Other areas of lung may take over and try to compensate, but new lung cannot form. And this accounts for a lot of the mortality that occurs in advanced cases of respiratory distress in adults, particularly with the latest COVID-19 epidemic. In utero, the fetal lung is inert and it is collapsed. As the birth process advances and the second stage of labor takes place, it proceeds with the crowning of the head of the baby, and then the baby begins to make respiratory efforts. It is this inspiratory effort pressure on the alveoli that causes them to start opening. But they cannot stay open unless a surface tension lowering factor, known as surfactant, starts to flow through the lungs. So there are two processes which are responsible for the opening up of the lung: the pressure exerted by inspiratory effort and the flowing through of the lung of a substance called surfactant, which then lowers the surface tension and keeps the airspace open. Failure of either of these processes leads to the very important list of respiratory disorders of the newborn, which we have previously discussed.
Very interestingly, because I unfortunately landed up having a child that passed away 10 days later because in, I guess, the olden days, I'm giving away my age, they didn't have surfactant. Thank God today we do have that synthetically, right? And that is given to premature babies as they are born to help them with what it is that you are talking about. We're speaking to Dr. Kassel, and we're talking about the respiratory system, the lung, and all its disorders. If you'd like to join the conversation, 34519 is our SMS line. 061-895-1019 is our WhatsApp number.
This is the Healthy You, Wealthy You show with Adel Kasilski and Faggy Stern.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Kassel about everything to do with the lung. Dr. Kassel, one of the things, I know that I'm digressing a little bit, we've got lots to go through, but I find it fascinating that you say that lung is that is an organ that cannot regenerate itself. I thought all organs in the bodies are able to regenerate. I mean, they talk about the liver, you know, the skin obviously regenerates. Like, you know, we keep on making anew. So is the lungs that you're born with, surely they make new cells? Why doesn't it regenerate if it's disease?
It doesn't make new lobes of lung. It may regenerate its cells, but once the lung is damaged, and the main damage to the lung, funnily enough, they're beginning to learn now, comes in two ways. The one way is with excessive pressure on the lung with ventilation. In this way, you cause a condition known as bronchospastic dysplasia, where the lung just gets compressed and cannot interchange gases. Now, fortunately, this condition in the newborn can take a long time to disappear. It can take 18 months to 2 years to disappear, but it does open up and the lung starts interchanging gases again, sometimes not optimally. The second big problem arises, and they found this out with COVID-19 when they ventilated the patients. They found that one of the problems with COVID-19 was there was thrombosis of the vessels in the lung. And once this occurred, lung tissue died. It could not regenerate. Mm. And a lot of these people could not be got off the ventilator. So that lung tissue was dead. It had no way of, developing new cells, forming new cells. It was dead.
Is that then why people have long COVID? Like, people struggle because their lungs can't regenerate properly?
Yes. If you damage lung is probably the most vital asset in your body, as you're going to see later on. And the lung is something that should be treated with extreme respect, because you damage it and it's damaged, and it goes on being damaged. Want to smoke cigarettes for 20 or 30 or 40 years and destroy your lung tissue with coughing? It remains damaged. There is no new lung that...
Wow.
Just to continue, in respiratory disorders of the newborn, there are other conditions. Dominating the list is hyaline membrane disease of the newborn, where the alveoli fail to stay open due primarily to a lack of surfactant production, and this is particularly true of the premature baby. There are also other causes which we've discussed in previous presentations, and I'm sure you can get the podcast from Adel from the program. There are also other respiratory disorders of newborns, such as congenital pneumonia, a child born with collapsed lungs, known as atelectasis, diaphragmatic hernia, and congenital cardiac disease. in this situation is the same. The alveoli either fail to open or stay open. It's a fact that is lacking. Probably the greatest advance in pediatric medicine, certainly neonatal medicine in the past decade, has been the advent of surfactant. Surfactant has saved many, many babies' lives. But there's one specific point to remember about surfactant. The old saying that we use on this show, you've got to be proactive rather than retroactive. And now what is being done in a lot of the advanced neonatal units, as soon as the prim is born, as soon as it shows the slightest sign of respiratory distress, down goes the intubation tube, in goes the surfactant, and if necessary, the surfactant is repeated 6 or 12 hours a time. Never wait for the hyaline membrane disease to take hold, because once that happens, after 24 or 36 hours, you're fighting a losing battle. You may get the baby through, but you're going to prolong the ventilation, you're going to prolong everything. And in my last few years of pediatrics, I always found that the early introduction of the incubation tube, you needn't even leave it in. You just put it in, you give the surfactant, you take the tube out. It sometimes even removes the need for ventilation at all. It's a tremendous advance in pediatrics and will go on being so. Secondly, we come to the childhood and adult lung. The overriding problem in this category is undoubtedly the increasing influence of infections in determining outcomes. Whereas in the past, when I commenced medicine about 60 years ago, infection was predominantly bacterial, fairly well controlled by antibiotics. 90 to 95% of cases were that, and 5 to 10% were viral. Today, 80 to 85% of all upper respiratory and chest infections are viral, and 5 to 10% are bacterial.
What's changed? How come it's changed?
Well, many things have changed. The one thing that has changed is that, to start with, viruses, as a general rule, are not sensitive to any antibiotics at all. There are a few isolated cases, such as swine flu virus, which may respond to an antibiotic. But this antibiotic has so been overused for all sorts of conditions that it's now resistant, swine flu included. So gradually, the viruses have become completely resistant to antibiotic therapy. And even more disturbing than this is an article that appeared in the British Medical Journal. Now, the editor is not a holistic person, I don't think. He's not a homeopath, none of those things. But he wrote an article in this editorial, and he said, if you want to diagnose the glandular fever syndrome, clearly put them onto an antibiotic, and he named the antibiotic, which I won't do over here, it's not correct to do that. Put them onto an antibiotic, leave them on this antibiotic for 2 or 3 days, and they will have a full-blown and glandular fever syndrome if they are susceptible. And this is unfortunately what happens. We cannot arrange our psyche to understand that every red throat, every white spots on the throat is not, in fact, it isn't bacterial, it's viral. And if you put these sort of people onto antibiotics, you're running a grave risk of doing something which may provoke a glandular fever syndrome.
Well, Dr. Castle, we have this discussion so many times. Sorry, I know you have so much to go through, but, you know, so many people will put their kid on an antibiotic every couple of months because their kid is so chesty.
Well, certainly, after 60 years of practice, cannot go along with that philosophy, because all you're going to do is create a whole heap of resistant bacteria in the throat that respond to nothing.
So then do you do a throat swab every time?
You do a throat swab if you suspect a bacterial throat. A bacterial throat, what are the bacteria that you would normally treat with antibiotics? The dangerous forms of strep, Streptococcus Donsfield group A, the cause of nephritis and rheumatic fever. Not every strep. There are 70 different types of strep. You don't put them all onto antibiotics. You determine what strep. Now, what tells you that it's strep? A yellow pustular membrane on a scarlet red tongue, a red throat with a scarlet tongue, and a characteristic strep rash. Not white spots in the throat. That is not strep. You only need your eyes to tell you that.
Okay, you all heard it. We've heard it straight from...
Would it be the same thing for congestion, like if a kid is very congested in their lungs?
Well, how are you going to treat congestion that way? I mean, you don't know what's causing the congestion. Excuse me. Whereas 80 to 85% of chest infections are now viral and very poorly controlled, if controlled at all by antibiotics, each year is marked by outbreaks of ever-increasing severity of viral infection, reaching epidemic or even pandemic proportions. In the last decade alone, we have had the H1N1 virus, swine, respiratory syncytial virus, and of course the famous group of COVID viruses, culminating in the recent outbreak of COVID-19 infections, which reached epidemic and then pandemic proportions. Attempts to control or reverse the situation have been made with the introduction of vaccines, but the time is fast arriving to look how best we can manage our body's defenses more effectively by increasing our own immune system in conjunction with other factors that are already in use. As an example of what I'm saying, we have had the emergence of hospital antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which are becoming a tremendous problem, so-called killer bacteria, which respond to nothing. And this is obviously due to the overuse of certain antibiotics and the bacteria becoming resistant. May I say it over here, because we're still going to do a separate program on vaccinations, but I am a firm believer that you have to have a careful look at all these things. Nobody is disputing vaccination. Vaccinations have saved millions and millions of lives, including in the COVID-19 pandemic. But there is too much literature appearing in the medical literature at the moment, stressing the side effects that may occur with vaccination. It can no longer be disputed that there are definitely conditions that have increased where people have been vaccinated. So the decision has to be that of your doctor. There's no quick fix for anything. And there's one has to remember that a virus, the history of a virus is to find a resting place in your body. It mutates down in severity, so that whereas it may be deadly to start with and kill off many people, by the time it's mutated 5 or 6 times, it's no more than a common cold. And this is particularly true of COVID-19 at the moment. So I, for one, am not in favor of trying to eradicate completely a virus from your body. You cannot do that. The virus finds a resting place in your body. So vaccines have proved effective and life-saving, but as virus mutate, we all know that the vaccines have to be remodeled, booster doses have to be made, booster vaccines, with the problems that come with this, which I believe. My discussion would be incomplete if in childhood and adult lung, I did not mention the important role of the allergic response in influencing respiratory disorders. The allergic response, fortunately, is usually a buildup of increasing severity. Just to give you an example, you get stung by a bee because you're susceptible to bee stings. And there's definitely a tendency for this, which it's believed that the person who gets stung by a bee actually secretes on their skin something that attracts the bee, and therefore the bee comes to them all the time. So the individual gets stung once, gets stung twice, gets stung three times, gets stung four times, and each time, with each successive allergic stimulus, it starts first of all with peripheral responses, such as rashes and irritation. But then with the increasing outpouring of histamine, it may progress to affecting the internal organs, of which the respiratory tract is the main process, is the main focus. In the majority of cases, these manifest as hay fever, rhinitis, sinusitis, but even in the more severe cases, may progress into the lung itself, flooding the alveoli with allergic fluid, which if extreme may cause sudden death. And this has happened. People dying within 5 minutes of obesity. But there is a time frame. You have a chance. You can do ROS testing in the laboratory and determine the degree of allergic sensitivity. If the ROS test is beginning to become increasingly positive, then a bracelet should be worn, school should be informed, and the child should carry an antidote on himself or herself in the form of EpiPen.
That's quite a scary thing. I mean, it's not early bee stings. It's other things.
No, it's very seldom an early bee sting. In fact, not. There's usually an initial reaction, a small red blob, and gradually it progresses.
But even with nuts and all other type of allergic reactions.
Same thing.
But is it, I just need to understand, it happens, what, genetically, that a person is more susceptible, or just, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't desensitize. I mean, they've got this whole thing that in Israel, you know, most of the kids are not allergic to peanuts because they give them bamba at 6 months. Is that nonsense?
Desensitization, if I'm correct, certainly when I left the practice, desensitization was largely being abandoned, because with the desensitization substances, they were getting such severe reactions that they were actually life-threatening. I think here lifestyle is important, and as we are now doing with the lady sitting right on my right-hand side, we are determining genetic predispositions to all these things. And Adel, this is one of the things that you should begin studying. Why are people allergic? Probably
it is a histamine, but histamine is a genetic issue.
It's a genetic issue, yes.
Our histamine is a genetic thing.
Of course.
That's
some people are like severely allergic to things like, you know.
And it's familial.
It is familial. I have a member of my family, one of my little ones, that's become very allergic to nuts. And there is a cousin, you know, who's also got a kid. That's the same three nuts, not all nuts, the same three nuts. So it's got, it must have some type of familial.
Is it not connected to a specific enzyme that our bodies can't make?
Well, it's called genetic.
But then isn't there a way of like taking a specific enzyme that can help break down the histamine?
If you determine the genetic predisposition and you determine the genetic factors that are causing it, sure, you can eliminate.
We're speaking to Dr. Cussell, and we're really having a very interesting conversation. If you'd like to join us, 34519 is our SMS line. 061-895-1019 is our WhatsApp number. You're listening to the Healthy You Show on 101.9 FM.
This is the Healthy You Wealthy You Show with Adel Kosilski and Faggy Stern.
We're talking with Dr. Cussell about everything respiratory just during the break, but maybe for our listeners. We were talking about how to react to allergic reactions, and we're talking about the EpiPen. Maybe for our listeners, I said, what is an EpiPen? I mean, I know you need to use it. What does it do?
it immediately hampers the allergic response. It decreases the histamine and removes the fluid immediately. Cortisone takes 6 to 12 hours to do this. It's too long to wait. But you may have lost the patient at that stage.
Okie dokes. Right, let's continue.
Well, just to digress for one second, I did mention genetics. And I remember a lecture when I first entered medicine. It was in 1954. The lecturer was Professor Philip Tobias Olmsted, probably the greatest lecturer that the medical school ever had. You know what his lecture was? The bad germ is being replaced by the bad gene. Watch out for the next 15, 20, 50 years. It's now being replayed, his total prophecy. And hopefully here in South Africa, we will take the lead in determining the bad gene. We are doing it already. Number three, the aging lung and the pleural membrane. This is the category of respiratory disorder where we have the greatest chance of preventing or even eliminating progression before a stage of chronicity is reached, which then becomes irreversible. The main disorder in this category is the condition of emphysema. This chronic disorder may take years to develop and is due to a prolonged and sustained attack on the lung tissues, mainly the elastic fibers of the lung, but also the pulmonary fibrous tissue, which comes about through chronic persistent coughing and irritation that eventually tears and destroys the elastic and fibrous tissues. It's always been a mystery to me, because I actually watched a member of my family take 10 years to die from emphysema, chronic fibrosis, and lung and oxygen dependency. It was my late father. And on the day he died, he lit up a cigarette. Mm. It was beyond any comprehension that anybody could do anything like this, but they do it. So the choice is yours, live or die. Nobody can help you. The net result will eventually seriously impact the mechanism of breathing so that normal inspiration and expiration cannot occur. And the impaired exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide will not take place. As this happens, there is increasing morbidity, increasing suffering, lack of quality of life, leading to oxygen dependence, walking around with portable oxygen cylinders until life is no longer sustainable. Probably one of the most terrible deaths that anyone can experience. Do we need to ever to be reminded of the vital environmental factors that bring this about? And it's not only tobacco, it's toxins in the environment, certain foods we eat, the vaping, as well as the inhalation of toxins, asbestos. Remember, on every packet of cigarettes is now legislated that there should be a message, smoking kills. Okay.
I think we just must emphasize vaping. Like, everybody thinks, well, if I vape, then I'm much safer than smoking.
Probably more dangerous.
Exactly. And we're seeing more and more people, young people, collapsing and suffering and even dying.
And dropping dead.
Yeah, from this vaping. So don't be fooled thinking that, okay, I'm not... You know, I spoke to somebody who was a smoker, and I kept on saying, you know, you're killing yourself every day with every drag. He goes, no, it's fine now, I'm vaping.
Right.
And I went, no, you just, you know, swapped one irritant with another.
It's the chemicals that are so shocking.
It's all the same lung irritants, the same way of killing yourself.
You know, when I walk into my kitchen, if there's been a spray that's been used and it's like chemicals, it really has an effect on me.
Absolutely.
I can't breathe. Never mind vaping and smoking it into your lungs.
Absolutely. Finally, we come to rupture of the pleural membrane and the subsequent tearing of the lung. With this, air will immediately enter the thoracic cavity. This condition is known as pneumothorax, and if it is accompanied by hemorrhage, it is known as hemopneumothorax. If this condition is not recognized and relieved immediately by the insertion of a drainage tube into the thoracic cavity, each breath taken through the torn and damaged lung and pleural membrane will cause the rapid accumulation of trapped air in the thoracic cavity, compromising and compressing at first the heart and then the remaining lungs, and will lead to death eventually. This is the main cause of death in motor car accidents. And please take notice of what I'm saying now. The wearing of seat belts is not something, not an excuse to give the law enforcers an excuse to give you a ticket. It is a way of saving your own lives, because in car accidents, the tendency is for the bodies to be thrown forward. And when this happens, it hits the chest and the ribs, not being durable structures, fracture. And the moment a rib fractures and the rib pierces the lung, that is the beginning of the end. As you take air in, so air begins to accumulate in the lung. And if you should remember one first aid procedure that can save a person's life, it is to insert anything into the chest, provided you can get into the chest, to let that trapped air out. Now, if you let the trapped air out, the patient will survive to the hospital. This completes my review of the three basic conditions affecting the upper, the lower, and finally, respiratory tracts, and finally, the lung and pleural membrane itself. I leave you with this thought. We commence life as air is breathed into our lungs and cease life as the lung closes and air can no longer be breathed out of our lungs. The lung needs to be treated with the greatest respect at every stage of life. It is a vital asset we cannot live without. Thank you.
And that is very, very wise words, as always, from our very wise Dr. Cussell. I love it because you just make medicine simple. The man on the street, the ordinary person who hasn't had 60 years of experience, can actually understand. And really, it's just about you understanding the greatness of your body. And I think what you're saying, most importantly, is having respect for your body. And, you know, making sure what you're putting in is vitalizing the body, not killing the body. Thank you again, Dr. Cussell, for your kind words.
Thank you, Abel, for your kind words. But it's very, very true, because what I've learned over 60 years of medicine is that the approach, the natural approach, leaving it to nature in the first instance, is probably the best approach. Never forsake that approach. They're all the medicines on earth that you can use. But with all the medicines on earth, you begin to get reported the side effects. And it becomes like a seesaw. Eventually, everybody goes manic about it, and everybody uses the drug. Then everybody starts to report the side effects, and nobody uses the drug. And then eventually the drug finds its middle road, and then it gets used when it should be used. Nature and Hashem never operated in that way. They designed our bodies so that our bodies know what to do.
See, this is our best call on the Healthy You, Wealthy You show. This is why we're here. This is why we have these discussions. If there's any discussions you or diseases you'd like us to look into, or people you'd like us to talk to, you can easily send an email to info@fivefm.com. Also, a reminder that Fabi and I run a WhatsApp group every single day. It's admin runs. We don't drive you mad. You can leave it on, even on silent. We just drop a thought. I motivate myself by just, you know, every day looking at something that I can do better in my life so that I can, as Dr. Cussell says, take, let nature take its course, let Hashem look after you. Of course, I'm not advocating that you should ignore the allopathic world. They are definitely there. It's needed. It's important. But there is so much that we can do. Thank you again for joining, Faggy. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Around, and we'll be back same time, same place next week. This is 101.9 High FM.